Robert's been on this podcast before, I think. He might have been here even in person once.
I don't remember being on it.
Really?
I might have been. I've been on a lot of podcasts. So.
Let's search. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's see. Dun, dun, dun. You were on... That's a different Robert.
Did you just search for Robert?
Robert Carteno. Is it possible that Robert Scoble has never been on a Stack Exchange podcast?
It is possible. Well, why don't you do the intro and then we can talk about it on the podcast.
You're listening to the Stack Exchange podcast, coming to you from Stack Exchange headquarters with Stack Exchange CEO Joel Spolsky, Jay Hanlon, David Fullerton, producer Alex.
Hello.
And special guest Robert Scoble.
Hey, nice to be on.
This is podcast episode number 44. So, Robert, who are you?
I'm a geek who gets around and meets startups and tech innovators. Right now, by the way, I'm inside Flipboard's headquarters in Palo Alto, California. I just saw their new stuff coming out in a month or two. So that's what I do. I come around and see new stuff that hasn't hit the market yet and usually take a video of it and put it up and think about what it means for the world, the industry, and for Rackspace where I work.
Does it tell me the truth now? Is it sort of an echo chamber? I always thought that Flipboard was a classic. Oh, I don't know, like a thing that everybody in Palo Alto knows all about, but nobody outside of Palo Alto ever uses.
They have millions of users and they're not all in Silicon Valley.
I guess that's true.
They were one of the first killer apps on the iPad.
Yeah,
true. The iPad has become a pretty interesting little device in the world.
That'll never work.
Dozens of them every time I fly on a plane. So somebody's using these things and Flipboard usually comes up as one of the top apps on the iPad.
On the iPad.
And now it's on Android too, by the way. So
Flipboard is essentially a pretty magazine-y Google Reader type client, is that right?
Well, it takes all your social networks, so Twitter, Facebook, Google Plus, Instagram, Tumblr, and a bunch of others, and tries to make that into a magazine that's pleasant to read. They also have been doing a lot of partnerships with professional content people or content brands, New York Times and National Geographic and Rolling Stone magazine and stuff like that, to create an online magazine house, basically, or a content house that you flip through on your iPad or your Android tablet or your phone.
It always seemed a little bit weird to me. You know what it felt like to me the first time? I might have been looking at an old version of Flipboard, but somehow I felt like it was sort of like the in-flight magazine on Uzbekistani Airlines.
Well, its quality does depend on who you follow on Twitter and on Facebook.
But, well, so, what was happening is that, like, the captions...
Maybe you need to increase the quality of your friends. It is a little bit hard to use, and they're working on that. That was part of what they're showing, that they're trying to become easier to use for my dad, for instance. My dad, for instance, doesn't do much Twitter or Facebook. And so if he just opened up Flipboard without me being involved, he wouldn't see very good content. And you need to know how to add a list or how to add a SoundCloud feed or an Instagram feed or a Facebook list. And it's a little bit hard to figure out. And even when it seems simple, like on an iPad, and somebody like me can figure that out in seconds, but there's a lot of people out there who are like, what's a Twitter feed?
Joel, as a side note, I think you should stop liking the It's Just Lunch dating service in SkyMall. That may be jamming up your experience with the application.
This is the problem.
Yep. We're heading into a new age where what you liked and who you liked really affects the future of your life online.
It is certainly true. I try to like things that I know I'm actually going to like, although Facebook has gotten...
Somebody write that down. I need that framed on my office wall.
Facebook has gotten remarkably prescient. I just sort of freaked out when Facebook started showing me ads specifically for shirtless men with puppies. It's like a little, just like one degree too accurate.
When the filters start going crazy and advertising is always fun. Right now it's showing me a Salesforce ad, so...
that's hopeless. No, what I meant by the Uzbeki Airlines thing is that they would get... A lot of times there would be a picture and the HTML doesn't really tell you what the caption of the picture is.
Yeah.
And so sometimes they would pull out the wrong thing to use as the caption and then they would like abbreviate it. So it would be like the first five words of an advertisement that had nothing to do with the picture, and the picture would be just the wrong picture because it would suck the wrong picture out of the page. And it just sort of looked like somebody who didn't read English was in charge of editing this damn thing, which indeed is the case with Flipboard. Somebody, their computer, you know, their code, their algorithms, who don't actually really read English all that well, you know, would try to assemble something and it would, you know, 80% of the time would be great. And if you just sort of ignore that, you're used to it, it's fine. But if you think of it,
it's getting a lot better. There's a whole team here. In fact, they hired 10 people last week alone here at Flipboard. Wow. There's a whole team here that's working on these filters to figure out how to bring the right thing to you. And I think it's, you know, and they're not the only ones working on it either. There's Prismatic, and CNN has a team that they bought from Zeit. And there's a lot of people working on this problem. And Facebook, of course, is working on it with their EdgeRank team, their feed quality team. They're trying to pick 10 or 20 items to show you every time you refresh that browser that you will find interesting and not think is stupid. You know? That's how you keep people addicted to your product. Otherwise, they leave and go somewhere else, right?
That's actually, I mean, we're actually trying to do the same thing. So I won't tease them or throw any stones at their glass houses. What do you think, by the way, Robert, what do you think about Facebook search, graph search thingamajiggy? I just got it turned on.
I like it and I hate it. I think it's the future of search because I really want to do my searches that way. Show me all single people in San Francisco who program Ruby on Rails. Uh-huh. You know? But it doesn't let me do it. There's too many edges to it. And I hit too many things that don't bring any results back.
Right.
And of course, it's not hooked up to the full depth of Facebook yet. I can't say, show me all items about the PlayStation 4 yet, you know, or show me all items about the PlayStation 4 that my friends have liked. If I could do that, that would be really magical. You know, they're working on it a piece at a time and they haven't hooked it up to content yet.
I feel like they have this graph of all this knowledge of what people do and what people like, and it's really sparse. You don't really notice it because you see, every time you look at Facebook, you're seeing more information. But it doesn't occur to you that they don't know that somebody's a Ruby programmer. That person may never have put the fact that they're a Ruby programmer into Facebook anywhere.
No, I mean, but you would be shocked at how many people actually do. Let me actually try that.
Yeah, so, it was getting people that are programmers
who
that work for,
like who program.
I got people named Ruby who work as programmers.
On Rails. Let's see if that works.
People named Ruby don't count.
And it's sitting here, and it's slow. Also, that's another problem.
Let's see how many I can find on my little careers.
Yeah, see, it's trying to bring things like shopping and retail places. My friends, it gets confused, you know. So, yeah, friends,
we got. If you actually do the real search on the Stack Overflow careers, you got 62 programmers.
Yeah. By the way, somebody...
Wait, that's jobs. I'm looking in the wrong place. Sorry.
Yeah.
But you can't search for singles. That's what he wanted. He wanted people who are single who program in Ruby.
Careers has been missing that feature for quite some time.
I think technically it's illegal to use in hiring decisions, so that might be a reason.
Singleness?
Try search for
singularity?
Marital status.
Yeah.
So the Facebook graph search, I mean, you can see where they're going with it, right? And it seems really cool. It's just, it isn't quite there yet, right? You get the feeling every time you use it, you're a little bit sad that it didn't quite tell you what you wanted to know.
Yeah. And in fact, in this situation, it's not bringing back even close to what I want, which is friends who program in Ruby on Rails. I'm not even sure. Can I see my friends?
They don't, you know what? I don't program in Ruby on Rails. But if I did, I would not tell Facebook. We got Stack Overflow Careers has 668 Ruby on Rails programmers in San Francisco. So there. And these are actual Ruby programmers.
Yep.
Because Facebook just doesn't, it's got all this weird, like wrong likes. It's constantly telling me that David liked the Bank of America or whatever, things that are totally not true.
Well, I did that because they offered me a $5 coupon.
If you look
coupon.
At his like feed, he probably actually did like it at some point because he got bribed by Bank of America to save $20 or get $20 in his checking account or something like that. So actually, I did find my friends who like Ruby on Rails. So if you ask it for like, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole page of people who...
Yeah, that's not bad.
There's 12,000 people on Facebook who like Ruby on Rails, and lots of my friends like it as well. So it brings back some interesting stuff. Oh. You know, you can do restaurants, like my friends who like Chinese restaurants in Palo Alto, you know, or who have checked in, stuff like that. But it has too many edges on it. And as the edges disappear, this method of searching and finding things and, you know, places, people, and things in Facebook will be very useful.
I think it needs like a whole new, like a radical leap forward, though, because I just think there's not the information isn't dense enough that you would ever trust it. You know what this feels like? Alta Vista search. Like, oh, what a coincidence. I found, you know, like it might help you, but it's not really going to find it.
It's pretty harsh.
You know, I remember when this thing called Google came out and, you know, there was Alta Vista and there was Yahoo. And I had a really popular net meeting website and Yahoo never, ever listed it. So I always hated Yahoo. And Alta Vista always listed me number one and my friend's site number three. And there was a porn site number two. And then Google came out and I was number one and my friend was number two and no porn.
Yeah.
So so that's why I fell in love with Google right away, because it was right and there was no spammy porn shit. You know?
They just had like none of the garbage and 10 times more results that were actually closely relevant. And that's what I think that's where the Facebook would have to go. But they, you know, the number of things that people actually like that they like is slim. You know, they see things. Yeah. It's just things that came through their feed that they
wanted. I think when they hook up content, because people are liking content on Facebook, when they add that, you know, show me all articles about the PlayStation 4 that have 20 or more likes, that would be really cool.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Seeing, you know, Chinese restaurants in Palo Alto that my friends like is somewhat cool, but it's not as cool as the content piece, and they haven't hooked up the content piece yet.
No, that's a really good point, because you go to a restaurant, how often do you go to their page and like their page? But you might post a picture from it or something, and if they can they can figure that out, then they start to have a lot more rich information.
And if you post a picture of a great meal in a Chinese restaurant and it gets a lot of likes from people and from your friends, and that gets bubbled up, that will be useful, because it's not, you know, I can already figure out which is the popular Chinese restaurant on Yelp and on Google. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can say that it's not really that human, or it's the data is a little dirty because of gaming going on.
No, but
generally it brings back a pretty good list on both of those services. But if you start adding in content and likes on top of that, now I can see what meal is going to be best in Palo Alto, and that changes the game, I think.
What did you think of Twitter when it came out, Joel?
I didn't like Twitter. Yeah. It was too short. There was not enough room to type. It's still true. I just got it. I'm in a flame war right now with somebody on Twitter for hosting our own servers for Stack Exchange, rather than just, you know, putting it directly on Amazon, which would be cheaper and better, he said.
Cloud computing is not necessarily cheaper. It is cheaper if you have spiky traffic. If you have very consistent, large traffic, it often is cheaper to host your own. You know, by the way, this is why we believe open source and OpenStack is so important, because you can run it on your own servers, or run it on our servers at Rackspace, or run it on our own hosted cloud. I think that gives companies a lot more choice on where they go in the future. You know, cloud is not for everything.
Right.
It might be for everybody, but it's not for everything.
And cheaper is not the only variable here, right? I mean, one of the things we want is control and access, particularly at a time when that may be limited, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. And openness is going to be a big, big problem in the future, you know?
I've always said that people that are going to, you know, Heroku or Amazon or whatever are actually they're paying, and they're getting this sort of abstraction of a layer that they just are willing to say, listen, I'm going to pay a little bit extra money and I don't care enough about that particular thing, the hosting, because, you know, I'm going to differentiate myself somewhere else. There's some other thing that I care about, or because I'm small and I'm a startup. But it's not, can you imagine if Facebook was just hosted on AWS? That would be, they would have, like, you know, they would need 10 times the infrastructure. They'd never be able to do the things.
Yeah, I've been inside a Facebook data center. It's a 300,000 square foot data center, and I think they have four or five of them now, right?
Probably.
They're building their own servers
doing
now,
stuff
they?
Like graph search for a billion people takes a lot of computing power.
Right.
And that's cheaper when you have consistent high traffic to build your own. Right. Otherwise, Facebook, you know, would have gone on to Amazon or Rackspace or some other cloud.
It's a question of, like, are you big enough to hire several of your own system administrators and have that just be kind of a rounding error on the profit and loss statement, right? Like, it doesn't, you know, so what? So we have four system administrators, big deal. That doesn't, you know, cost us very much relative to, you know, everything that we do around here.
And there's,
but for
you know,
a small
there's
company,
hybrid
that's a big deal.
Too. You know, your database server, you might want on the fastest machine you can afford, or a series of machines, you know, bare metal machines that you control, but your images, it might not be as important to have high availability and, you know, low latency machines for those. So you could put those up on cloud computing.
Yeah.
And we've seen lots of companies do that where they host a couple of machines themselves that are really key to their business. And then everything else is out on cloud.
So, Robert, you're writing a book with Shel Israel.
Yeah.
Which has been well covered. Of all the unpublished books, it's certainly got a, you're sort of doing all the marketing in advance. Book coming
well,
out.
We're doing the content out in public. I believe in open source, and I believe open source or open approaches improve everything you do. So we're posting, like today, we're going to post the interview I did yesterday with Mark Andreessen. And so you can see that, and you can tell me, oh, you should have asked this question or mm-hmm. whatnot. And then you'll see the chapters as we write them and other material that we put up. And you'll see that way in advance of the book coming out, and that helps improve the book because people have already written us and said, you know, oh, did you know the NFL is doing a contextual system? No, I didn't know that. And I wouldn't have known that if we hadn't done this in open, right?
So the entire book will effectively be available online before you start collecting any money for it?
Yeah, well, we've already gotten paid for the book. So, you know, that's it's pretty nice. We have several sponsors from Microsoft to BetaWorks to Rackspace. There's a whole list of it we put up on our blogs. So we already have enough money to produce the book.
But I mean, from the customer perspective, customers will still buy the ebook, I assume.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. They'll be buying it on Amazon or wherever they want their book to be bought. We'll be there. But yeah, we did this with our first book. And Shel and I wrote Naked Conversations about 7 or 8 years ago now, which was all about social software and corporate blogging. And we put every chapter up before it was published, and we still sold 40,000 copies.
Yeah, you're going to sell more copies. I know that. I did that for my own book, and it was A Press's bestseller, and it was just my blog article sort of reselected. You know, yep. One of the advantages is I could go back. You know, I would write a blog article, and if I misspelled something or made a typo or just got something gratuitously wrong, I could then either leave it out of the book or rewrite it or cover it up in some way somehow.
We're actually using Guy Kawasaki, who just wrote a book on self-publishing called mm-hmm. APE, APE, Author, Publisher, Entrepreneur. Mm. And he found thousands of errors in the book by putting the chapters up and letting everybody, you know, mm-hmm. Copy edit them or fact check them in public. And that's absolutely true. On our first book, one guy grammar checked the whole book and fixed dozens of problems. Yeah.
Joel, thanks to your clever comments on, I think, our sysadmins being rounding errors, every one of them has asked for a raise already. So we'll be working on that.
They're
for
very
next
sad right
podcast.
Now. We're trying to make them happier. Uh-huh. So wait, tell us a little bit more about what the book's about.
Yeah, so it's called Age of Context. So I started seeing a pattern by interviewing all these executives last year that the number of sensors on us or around us is going up exponentially. So we're all seeing things like Basis Watch, Fitbits, Jawbone Up. The Nest thermostat has a sensor in it.
Our cell phone has, I think,
seven sensors in it. And so the number of sensors is going up exponentially. Then I started hearing about the Google Glass project, and we are seeing a whole bunch of wearable computers. So wearable computers are going up exponentially. You know, big data is, so databases are increasing in size, increasing in quantity, and increasing in computation. So there's a whole database innovation thing going on. And then social media data keeps going up. Twitter is close to 1 billion tweets a day right now, and it's doubling every 12 or so months. And so is Facebook, so is Google+, so is Pinterest, right? Pinterest just got $200 million yesterday of investment. Why? Because their numbers are going up exponentially.
Yeah.
And location data is going up exponentially. The amount of data about our world that we're walking through is going up every day. And so you add those five things together, and it lets you build contextual systems. For the customer, systems are going to get more personalized. You're going to sit in your General Motors car, and it's going to go, hey, Joel. And it's going to know where you want to go because your cell phone will have already told the car where your next appointment's going to be, right? And it also is going to be...
Wait a minute. Who cares if my car knows where I'm going to go? What's it going to do? Is it going to drive me there?
Well, eventually. 15 years from now, we will have self-driving cars. But right now, I have to sit there for 2 minutes and punch in my Toyota navigation system.
I can't even get Alex to tell me where I'm supposed to go next, and that's his job.
Oh,
that's why.
Oh, really?
The cloud is going to replace Alex.
I do that now though. Whenever we go somewhere, I use my Android phone for the navigation. 1 second. You know, the Google Now tells me where the next appointment is, and I just tap it, and it's
Google does some crazy stuff. I just got an Android phone to play with my first Android device, and it's kind of creepy sometimes. You search on any device for a location, and all of a sudden your phone pops up with directions to get there.
Yeah. Yep.
It's pretty cool.
And it knows how the traffic is. So
that's what Tempo is supposed to do too, right?
Yep. And in fact, I use Tempo to get here to Flipboard. So on my Google Calendar, I just put Flipboard. And on Tempo, I click on it, and it actually filled in the address of Flipboard's headquarters.
What the heck is Tempo?
Tempo is a new iPhone, iOS app. It was developed by SRI, which made Siri before it was sold.
Oh.
Yep. And this lab is the number one lab in Silicon Valley. It invented HDTV. It invented the mouse. It invented haptic feedback for electronic surgery and all sorts of other fun stuff. So this is an important lab. And so when it does something, it usually is pretty interesting to pay attention to. But it's looking inside my email, inside my calendar, inside my contacts. And then it's also using the web to look up addresses and other things. And it pulls that context up and builds a report for each calendar item. And it's really pretty good, including for conference calls. So one thing I used to hate about conference calls is you always had to put the pin in.
Yeah.
And if you're driving, it's really dangerous. Now all I do is click one button and it does the phone number, and then it automatically puts in the pin number. Oh. And it's really cool.
I thought you were going to say you just get it to drive the car while you type in the pin.
Sergey hasn't given me one of those yet. No. I hope I'm alive to actually have my own self-driving car, because I think they're really cool. But I think they're 15 years away before they're affordable for me.
Is there any doubt that in anyone's mind that Joel is envisioning Kit from Knight Rider right now? It's the only possible explanation. He's put on a leather jacket and a strange curly-haired wig. It's
funny you joke about that. One of my friends had, when I worked at Microsoft, one of my friends had a car that you could talk to 7 years ago and then get it to do things like navigate or play music. And so it's just now that the stuff is starting to actually work, in a real way for the
That's an important part. I've always had a car that I could talk to, but I couldn't get it to do things when I talked to it.
My car has refused to play music for me for years when I talk to it. This is an old idea.
I like it when it's a little bit more passive. Like, I like it when the auto search suggestions, as you start typing and it comes up with search suggestions, I like it when those are sort of intelligent, like they're actually sort of identifying that you might be searching for something that's physically close to you. And, they bring that up higher in the auto search suggestions. I don't know if one thing I'm afraid of is if I write down that I have an appointment at Google or something, and it then, books me a flight to the wrong city, because when it looked up Google, it found their Edinburgh office. There's a certain amount of like human knowledge that does have to be applied in those things. The automated things always get like 90%.
That's what SRI is doing that's really interesting. They're looking through your email to figure out where you really are talking about. Hmm. And they're trying to find that in your email conversations back and forth. Because if I made an appointment with Joel to have lunch, we would probably have discussed what city and what restaurant and all that, because I know, human-wise, he's in New York and I'm in Silicon Valley. So I need to be clear about
stuff.
That with Joel.
Look, if I tell you let's go to Irving Farm, then there's three branches. And
we might be meeting at South by Southwest. So we would have written, hey, are you going to be at South by Southwest? Yeah, I'm going to be there. Should we go
there's
to
no
barbecue? Yeah, we should go to Lockhart, Texas. So
I'm going to try it.
It actually is really good
work.
About seeing that conversation and pulling the right thing out of the conversation. But false positives are really a problem for them.
Right.
They work hard at not getting them. But I do see a few false positives, but they're pretty obvious when they're false positives.
You can't get it yet, Joel.
I don't know. It's sort of like the first things that happened when the first generation of spell checkers was sort of context-free, and they would correct and autocorrect words into other words that were correctly spelled, but were nevertheless the wrong word in that context. And it became even harder to proofread because you didn't see a word, that just ended in a GHLQ. You saw an actual English word, and it took a lot more brain cycles to discover as you proofread that you had actually just simply typed the wrong word because it had autocorrected into something that was a right word.
A proactive guessing engine can't be 90% right. It's infuriating, right? It's got to be higher.
It makes it look better. So if I put down an appointment and I say, I want to meet at Irving Farm and there's three of them, and you then go look that up and you give me the one that's closest to me because that makes the most sense, but it's not actually the one either of us intended because we meet at Irving Farm all the time. And yet it nevertheless steers me to the wrong Irving Farm. But then it's telling me the address and it looks so definitive. And I'm like, did I put the address in there or did you just figure this out?
And it drives itself. You just get in and then...
You have no choice. The car will not unlock until you get... The seatbelt fastens. You are forced. It's like...
But this is just always of saying it's still early times, right? It'll get there though. You can kind of see where it's going, and some of it'll work and some of it won't, and the things that work will be surprising.
All right. What else is what other cool things are you seeing, Robert?
Well, you know, I'm waiting for these Google glasses, but
they sort of announced yesterday that people can apply for them.
It's an essay contest.
Man, there's a whole range of health things coming out. You know, I have a Basis watch on me that measures my heart rate and watches my activity level and stuff like that. If you match that up with an app called Moves on the iPhone, which watches how far I walk or run or drive, and it's starting to build a list of places and things I do in my day, it's starting to become interesting that you can start to learn more about what you do and that motivate yourself to change your behavior. So you lose weight and stuff like that and get healthier. Mm-hmm. but there's a whole range of them, from the Nike Fuel Band to the Fitbit to the Jawbone Up to the Basis Watch. The Basis Watch just came out a month ago, and it's pretty interesting because it has a sensor that watches your heart rate and stuff. So it watches if you've actually exercised or not, and it gives you some goals.
Cool.
What else is cool that's lately? Tempo certainly was one of them that most people still aren't able to get. They have a waiting list to try out the Tempo calendar. Mailbox is in the same area if you're on the iPhone. You know, you try the Mailbox app, which replaces your email app, and it's really nice. I can't use it personally because I use a lot of labels. And Mailbox doesn't yet support those properly.
The Mailbox waiting list is my new favorite iPhone game. I check it every day, and the numbers are always getting better. I have a small sense of achievement on a daily basis. I think it's awesome.
Really, why are they not? Are they just trying to artificially create scarcity so as to create buzz?
These things take a lot of processing power, and you know, these things are growing so quickly. For instance, how long did it take Twitter to get to 13,000 users?
Oh, it's 15 years.
No, it took six months, right?
It was a lot.
So roughly.
It took 6 months for Twitter to get to 13,000 users, and Twitter had scaling issues for 4 years, even with that growth rate, right?
Yes. Well, it was. Don't forget that Twitter was useless because it was an SMS app.
Tempo got to 13,000 users the first hour it was out. So
let's talk Mailbox. There are 319,000 people still in front of me.
Holy
That's
moly.
Down from 570,000-ish when I started, and there are 490,000 behind me in line.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's only been out, a week?
You should know, sell your spot in
line. A week
and
a half, maybe,
should I get that?
10 days.
Now I want it. I was not knowing what all
exactly.
the fuss was about.
If 500,000 people want it, I must want it.
I have to download the app to get on the waiting list, right? It's just
must
a waiting
be
list.
Good.
App.
Yeah.
And that's the right. And that's the
we should make
is,
waiting lists.
Now that we have Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus and LinkedIn and all these things to talk to each other, we can find out something's hot within an hour, right? Yeah. And we all want it.
Hey, these
we
are
all want it at once.
These
and
are the flash mobs from Larry Niven.
Quite a different scaling problem than Twitter had to deal with, and Twitter still had extreme scaling problems, and still does really today. You know.
By the way, Joel, don't joke about that, because like LaunchRock made a business out of making waiting pages for startups based on Mailbox, I guarantee you someone is working on making a
Y Combinator startup.
There's probably a Y Combinator startup making make a waiting list app for your app.
You know what we should do this for?
Why waste time on 51? Waiting list apps?
Well, you know, I was talking to Mark Andreessen yesterday, and we were joking around about the Tesla and how the Tesla was tracking every movement that New York Times reporter was doing in the car. And he's saying, I'm
sort of
now suggesting to every entrepreneur that they instrument their app that way so that you know everything about what people are doing with your app.
But you know what? The other side of that story is that no single reviewer makes that much of a difference anymore. I mean, if you look at take something like, I know Trello, if you search for Trello reviews, you won't find, you know, it's not like the Wall Street Journal reviews it anymore. Mossberg didn't review it, but you'll find 300 people sitting and working using Trello, writing their personal reviews of Trello. Yeah. So there's such a dispersion of reviews that it's not like everything depends on the New York Times review being correct the first time.
No, there are two reviewers that still do matter.
Yeah, I think Pogue and Mossberg matter.
Pogue and Mossberg.
No, not them anymore. It's like the guy who works at Apple or girl who decides what's going to get featured in the store matters a lot, because that person can get you 10,000 new users a day, if not more.
Right.
And the same thing at the Android store, the Play store. Whoever decides what's going to get featured has a lot of power.
You're telling me that there's no corruption
your future
in
success.
That sounds like a great opportunity for the mafia.
Well, actually, we met the guy who does that.
Oh, there's lots of corruption. But, you know, if Apple gets corrupted, then they start putting stupid stuff in the store and everybody notices it. And so their power would go down. And so far, they've resisted that kind of corruption. But there is a different kind of corruption that they put in the industry. They reward apps that are Apple only. And so does Amazon, by the way. In fact, with our book, we're probably going to be Amazon only for the first 3 months, because they give you a lot of benefits. You know, if you decide to go Amazon only for a few months.
I think that makes sense for a book. They have like 80%, 90% of the e-reader, don't they? I mean, being Kindle only is probably safe.
I actually only read iBooks because I don't like switching apps, which is dumb. I have an Amazon app. I like having it all
on
my
phone. You just hold your iPad.
No, I literally have a Kindle app on my iPad, and I just prefer not to have two libraries.
Oh. What?
Well, you chose the wrong one.
I like the page turn navigation.
Oh, my God.
Animation, rather.
Now, all the books you buy are locked into that because of the
page turn
animation.
You're going to have to wait 3 months.
What do you mean locked into that?
Book?
Was I going to make an EPUB format and carry it around my pocket? It doesn't really matter.
You get to the idea, though, that app developers have to decide their marketing strategy. Are they going to be Apple only for a few months to get the goodies? And book publishers have to do the same thing. I have to decide, do I screw you if you want to read me on the iBook app? And I probably will, because, like you said, Amazon has most of the market.
You know what, Robert, you should do is make an Audible audiobook, because we hear they're wonderful.
I will probably do that, too. Yep.
It is sort of frustrating to programmers who are a key audience here that there's this whole political game you have to play to get distribution that they don't even understand and they don't really want to think about. Like, what marketing is today is so far into programmers. There's all this stuff about, like, trying to game to get in the top 10 charts and, you know, buying downloads in order to get on the top 10 charts. And it's just a lot of sort of
And if you do that unfair wrong, you stupidity. Get banned, right?
So yeah.
There's a gray area there, and then there's a black area, and some people are tempted to go too deep into the gray area.
Yeah.
You know, I just met with a bunch of bloggers up in Sun Valley, and we were talking about buying Twitter followers, which you can do, by the way.
But complete waste of time.
When you buy Twitter followers, they're extraordinarily low quality.
Are you
followers.
Kidding? They're all tens on OK. They would be tens on OKCupid. They're beautiful women.
Exactly. They're not real people.
I got to tell the story again. I was looking for a house cleaning service in New York, and I found one that finally had like 5 stars on Yelp, right? Whatever the maximum was on Yelp. So I thought that seemed good. And they got all these good reviews on Yelp that looked like they were written by real people. And they went to their homepage, and it said that they had, I don't know, 1,500 Facebook followers. And I thought, this is a little cleaning service in New York. They have 5 reviews on Yelp or 10 reviews on Yelp. How do I have 1,500 Facebook followers? That's not a reasonable number of Facebook or likes for a cleaning service in New York. And I clicked on it, and it looked like, you know, an ad for classmates.com, right? With just a whole bunch of beautiful women, like little tiny pictures that it was just very, very unlikely to be their clientele. and it occurred to me that they had just hired some CEO scummy person who had bought them a whole bunch of fake followers on Facebook, bought them a whole bunch of likes, bought them a whole bunch of fake Twitter followers, and then written, you know, 10 fake reviews for Yelp.
Why are fake followers hot women?
They just are.
Why not?
There are certain algorithms that the Facebooks and the Twitters will use to try to detect fake people. And they look to see that there's a certain amount of content. So the people have to be posting regularly, and they have to be posting real things. And they have to have a picture, not just a little egg. And so they randomly, for whatever reason, I don't know why they're all beautiful, but that's what they are.
Those are just the stock photos.
Yeah, they just get stock photos.
Where are you gonna find stock photos of ugly people?
Maybe that's why.
Those don't exist. You can't find those. You can only buy stock photos of beautiful people. I've looked into this.
ugly stock photos. That's a good business for OkCupid, actually, now as a side business. They can make some money, right? Because they know who's beautiful and who's not. Everybody's rated. Oh, dear.
I think people, if they really wanted to get noticed, they should hire a professional photographer. That will make them look a lot more beautiful.
Well, you'll definitely get better dates on OkCupid, that's for sure.
Yep. Anyways, what else is going on?
I don't know. What else is on our, what's on our agenda here?
Google Chrome just came out, a Chromebook, a new $1,300 Chromebook with a high-resolution screen, touchscreen.
Yeah, forget that. Don't care.
Yeah, I don't either. I'm saving my money for the Google Glass.
Yeah, they just announced you can enter a competition to win the honor of buying a $1,500 pair of glasses.
I don't really get the
who's
Google
wear
Chromebook.
Google
that's
Glass.
Like that.
I am.
No, I know
if
you are.
Already wear glasses, if you could get your prescription glasses built into it, it doesn't look bad.
That's not how it
but
works.
It looks ridiculous
its
own.
This has a little bit to me of like the Segway feel. If it does something amazing and interesting and novel and useful potentially, but I think the vast majority of people are going to be like, "Huh?" It feels very
I agree with you, but I'm still buying one.
Oh yeah, no. I am not surprised.
That feels like the easiest problem to solve though.
It's what?
The how it looks feels like an easy problem to solve. Like that, the fact that it's got this big bulky thing over your ear, that's gonna go away in a few years. I mean,
but this, you know, you bring up a good point. This could be the Apple Newton, right? Where it really is a great idea, but it will take another 10 years for it to be perfected and for culture to change.
Yeah.
And for the parts to get miniaturized even further and cheaper and better quality and all that. But this is one of those products where I feel like there's a real shift coming, and it'll do a lot of fun stuff that a cell phone doesn't. And you're already seeing them pitch it that way. Yesterday they released a bunch of videos where they show what the UI looks like and how it lets you take video from a first person perspective. This is like a new GoPro camera. If I was at GoPro, I'd really be watching this and going, how is this going to change the wearable camera industry, you know?
The YouTubers are super excited about this.
I totally am. Yeah. And by the way, they're not the only ones. You know, two Stanford students showed me a pair of glasses with a 1080p camera in it that looked even smaller than the Google one because it didn't have a display. And they said you could stream probably an hour and a half of video with one battery charge.
Wow.
And I've seen at CES, I saw a guy who built a prototype with two 1080p cameras. So it does 3D and for less than $2,000. And he said if he could get it up to any decent quantity, he could get them down. You know, the cost of the TI chipset he's using is not that much. So you could get them down to $300-$400 or less. Mm-hmm. Depending on the quantities. And so, you know, you take that out 2 or 3 years, what does this mean? We're going to have cameras in our world that we can't even detect. They're going to be that small. And you're going to be recorded. And you're not even going to know.
It's been making me crazy how often I see the cameras around me. I just think constantly just wishing constantly that they would not be visible to me.
There's all kinds of other little subtle things. Like Facebook is now checking people in when they use the free Facebook Wi-Fi at cafes in San Francisco. Yeah. Facebook provides free Wi-Fi in San Francisco. And they're just like, plunk, guess what? You're checked in.
I feel like Facebook now has interns like scurrying around watching me go places so they can keep track of it.
Yeah.
Feeding that graph.
And yet they don't know anything.
They're finding ways to feed that graph.
Well, they got to figure out who's a Ruby programmer in San Francisco.
Well, they'll get there.
I'll get there.
Yeah. It'll do other things. I mean, because you wear it on your face, augmented reality actually will work. You know, I was down at Qualcomm and they have a whole team working on augmented reality where you point your camera at a magazine, for instance, and something pops out of the magazine, a virtual, you know, monster or whatever. And the problem is
terrifying.
When you hold a cell phone in your hand, it's very jittery because you can't hold that cell phone very steady. And when you put something on your head, your head is Steadicam. We have 100 million years of evolution in our head to Steadicam our eyes. And so that kind of stuff is going to be very steady and look pretty good. And also, as we walk around and look at a box of Cheerios, things can pop on our screen and, you know, tell us stuff about it. You know, tell us that box of cereal is not great for our health or is good.
I need a way to attach my iPhone to my head now.
Well, you know, by the way, Apple is working on wearable computers. The watch just got...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
A bunch of Apple patents on the iWatch, but I know Apple's working on a wearable screen as well. They're just behind. Now, why are they behind? You know, Apple has really great supply chain, really great retail distribution, really great design. What don't they have? They don't know about our world. The Apple Maps absolutely sucks. And it sucks in San Francisco. So if it sucks in San Francisco, I know it sucks in the middle of Africa.
Oh, right? You should have seen. I was in Rio de Janeiro, and it was unbearably ridiculous.
Somebody almost died in Australia because of it.
But
did you
fair,
read that article?
I rake people regularly.
It drove them to the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
Like, it does suck, but it sucks. But Google has been sending human beings out mapping the entire planet, right, in cars and on foot for a decade.
Yeah.
Yep. And so the problem isn't that they blew it as much as they just couldn't do it right. It takes a decade of people traversing the streets.
And they knew that.
Well, they knew that, and they're starting to sense we're heading into a new era of product design where it's not how it looks, but it's what it does, what it knows about us, what it knows about our world. And they needed to cut that link between Google and Apple's databases because otherwise they would have a major dependency on a competitor who obviously wouldn't treat a competitor as well as they treat themselves, right?
Yeah.
And so
That's for sure.
I don't know. I don't see good things for Apple. And by the way, Andreessen doesn't see good things. And I was on a panel of four analysts last night at a tablet conference, and they don't see good things. They really are starting to wonder if Tim Cook is the right guy to lead Apple.
Well, I don't know if it's Tim Cook's fault, but one of the things I'm noticing is that Apple no longer has the best of breed app in any category. So literally every app on your iPhone is now replaced by something.
So what does that tell you?
Yeah.
They don't have the best software guys in the industry, and they don't know enough about us anymore. Yeah. They don't know my email. They don't know my calendar. They don't know my searches. They don't know my social behavior. So they don't know my buying behavior. You look at who knows who I am.
Yeah.
Amazon, Facebook, Google are in the top three. That's the triumvirate of companies that are set up well for this next age. Mm-hmm. And Apple, I'm probably going to buy a watch, but you know, I don't know.
They could still make the hardware. Listen, even if they're just making,
it's going to be beautiful, sexy
an awesome
hardware
platform.
But yeah. And they'll make lots of profits. I mean, their profits are unparalleled. But, you know, I'm talking about the future and where I'm going. I'm switching to Android for this reason. Mm-hmm. You know, Google Now is the coolest thing I've seen.
Yeah.
And on my Nexus 7 tablet, it's like, wow, that thing nailed a use case that Apple hasn't nailed. And I don't see a way for Apple to nail that. Apple forbids its employees from being on social media. So how is that culture?
That is
it's true.
You're
not if you work at Apple, you are not allowed to tweet or Facebook or blog on behalf of your company. Yeah. So you wouldn't be able to do what Joel does on his own blog, right? And so how is that culture of thousands of people going
to
shift?
Fair, I should institute such a rule actually here at the Stack Exchange. Yeah. No more tweeting.
we've been
Facebooking.
Mulling it over.
Productivity might go up, but it might go down too. Nah. You know? Like we talked about getting people in a flow state. You know, poking around on Facebook might be the trigger that gets people in a flow state.
We actually, you know, something I tweeted, which I didn't have time to talk about it in more depth, is that when we have this annual performance kind of thing where we try to figure out if everybody's getting paid appropriately, and we look at a long list of things that they do that they do or don't do, and that they can or they can't do. And we try to figure out, you know, what are some things that as a developer make you worth more money? And then we pay you more money because we feel like we kind of have to, besides it being the right thing to do. And one of the things that I tweeted about is like, look, being a famous programmer for what it means to be famous in the programming world is you blog, you have an open source toolkit that everybody uses, you've written a book, you speak at conferences, you know, or you're just sort of well-known because of some project that you did before. All of those things, you know, whether I want them to or not, they do actually increase your market value because people have heard of you and recruiters find you more often because you're coming up in more Google searches and people are thinking like, who could I hire to do X? You're going to come up and those add to your market value. So I actually think that we have no choice but to actually pay people more for blogging and pay people for speaking at conferences and pay people for writing books.
Yep.
We don't do it that directly, but it's just sort of, it's one of the things that, you know, we kind of add them up. And
$10 per blog post.
No, it's not that simple. It's more
13
like,
13
you know,
cents per tweet.
It depends on how many click-throughs we have.
It's number of characters.
First of all, we absolutely have to encourage you to be active in the community and to be well-known, even though in the long run, that can hurt us because that's essentially going to get you other jobs. But there's just no choice. And then once you do that, then we're forced by your famousness to pay you more.
And it's good for us. I mean,
yep.
It makes us look good, I guess, in the long run.
You know, everybody wants to be at a company where they empower you to be better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So let's take it to Google and Apple. Google is doing R&D in public with these glasses.
Yeah.
Apple is not. I haven't seen anybody wear an Apple Watch around.
Oh, no way.
So
no way.
What
that
does
would
that
be
mean?
Fireable.
I saw Sergey talking to people about these wearable computers and getting ideas for them and getting feedback and letting people try them on and seeing how they react to them.
Yeah.
That kind of R&D is hard work and is going to lead to a better product, and it's going to lead to a better understanding of the world. So I don't get how Apple is going to catch up with its secrecy and its lack of social media expertise into this new world where, you know, I want my watch to know things about where I am and tell me stuff and augment my life.
Yeah.
I think part of the Apple historical approach there too, though, and I don't know if they can continue it, was Steve Jobs had sort of that, you know, the people joke with the reality distortion field. The notion was people would believe that a device was whatever he said it was. And I think part of the reason they were so secretive then is they wanted to present it in the context of his narrative, and he would say it's magical. It's not just a giant iPhone. Don't call it that. And I think one question is, can Cook do that the same way? And do they need to? Would they be getting more out of it if they were getting more input earlier on?
Yeah, he's definitely not that kind of person.
The belief in Silicon Valley is his grade is going down by the day. And, you know, he came out of the supply chain, you know, which is really important. Understanding how that supply chain works is really important. But he's not... He's never done anything in his life to make me think he's a technologist or a visionary or a futurist or somebody who's going to, you know, be creative and come up with a new idea. I listened to him a couple times. I went to the last couple press conferences, and he just doesn't inspire me the way that Jobs did. You know, Jobs really did inspire me. And for a couple examples, with Flipboard, I'm sitting here in the office of Flipboard. Steve Jobs visited Flipboard and talked with them and understood what it was all about. Has Tim Cook done that to any startup? I haven't heard of that. And Steve Jobs also got Siri before anybody else did and begged the team to come to Apple, called them 30 times in the first month.
Yep.
Almost every day he would call the team and go, can you come to Apple? I'll do anything it takes.
They also, the touch technology was also acquired. The whole touchscreen, which made iPhone happen, was a team that they bought. I think that sometimes Apple is historically, I mean, even going down to, you know, going to Xerox PARC and seeing the WIMP, like they have this idea that we got to keep our eyes out and find these things before anybody else finds them and then buy them and make them and then productize them.
Yeah, and when was the last acquisition that was really interesting? You know, a lot of people, or it was rumored that they were going to buy Waze, but they just didn't get it done. Yeah. And even with the Apple TV, we keep hearing rumors about the TV, but they're not able to sign the content deals. In other words, Tim Cook is too timid. He's not willing to spend the $120 billion. I'm sure if you go into... you know, Discovery Channel's office and start pulling billion-dollar bills and laying them on the table until they cry uncle. At some point, that pile becomes big enough that they go, okay,
They don't have to do that. Look, they could do what Netflix did. They can just do one series, create one series.
Well, that costs $100 million to do one series.
Is that what House of Cards cost?
Apple wants to do bigger things than one series. You know, Steve Jobs wanted to disrupt things and change the world. And I just don't get that signal from Apple right now. And, you know, we'll see if it comes back. But it's starting to become noticeable. And I think that's why the market's reacting the way it is. That's why, you know, there's a malaise online. I'm watching Facebook. People are here. Hold on a second. Let me find something. The Verge just wrote about the iWatch, which looks pretty lame, actually. But, you know, Julian Blinn is like, I totally am in love with Google Glass, you know. And I see this over and over and over again, that at least Google's getting us to dream. Now, we might agree that it's not going to go mainstream, you know. He said, I am obsessed with Google Glasses. Smartphones and tablets are kind of a thing of a past already, in my opinion. And he worked for Samsung, right? So
it might be the segue, though, Robert. It might be like you put it on and there's something wrong. People laugh at you too much. There's something.
The segue looked awesome until you saw dudes riding around on it. And you're like, I don't know what makes it look so dorky, but there's something wrong.
Yeah.
I don't think
there might be a sociological thing.
I have enough
that
friends now who
this.
Wear them, and to a person, they say, I really miss them when I don't have them on.
Yeah, but you live in a bit of a place where it's okay to wear technology.
Yeah, you know, but the rest of the world might get out to the real world,
and people might find that they just get laughed at, or I don't know.
We'll know in a few months. I mean, but the segue. I don't remember exactly, but you laugh at me.
So I really don't care about that. I've never been.
No, I don't either. But most people do.
But the thing I care about is, do they have utility? Do they augment my life?
Right.
Do they make my life more interesting in some way? Do they help me beat you? You know, because we are in competition with each other. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not often talked about. But for instance, if I want to go to a famous restaurant in Palo Alto tonight, and we both want to go there, there's maybe one table available tonight. Who gets it first?
Not the guy who's got to move his hands to order it. No.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, I've been on a plane, for instance, and sitting on a tarmac, and I was watching TripIt.
Yeah.
And it said the plane is going back to the gate, and there's one other plane going out of town. I got one of three seats on that plane because I had the information 5 minutes before the pilot came on air and said, we're going back to the gate.
That's what Waze has got, all that data. That's what Waze is full of, all that like little extra useful data. I wonder if they could ever expand Waze beyond just traffic, give you more like get ahead in life data. We're running kind of late. Let me just see if the guys here have anything on their list to talk about. Anything we got on our podcast that we have to talk about?
We have a user question.
We have a user question?
We got a user question.
All right, let's do it. Let's entertain a user question.
So our user submitted question, a listener from a prior week submitted. Do we have a user identifier here? I don't think we do.
27.
Steven.
Okay. So let's call him Steven. So user Steven submitted a question saying, I just posted a relatively beginner question on Stack Overflow, yada, yada, yada. The gist of what he's getting at is that he got some answers, but what he was curious about was that he got multiple edits in a relatively short amount of time.
People edited his original question.
No,
his answer.
So what he saw, it's a normal thing on Stack Overflow. So people post one-line answers, being in competition.
Yeah.
People post one-line answers,
right,
and then they immediately start editing them to make them better.
Right.
And he even noticed that one of them, after a couple minutes, added a really interesting kind of edge case, and then that information magically just instantly appeared in the other two answers. And
they were copying each other.
So it was very clear that they were copying each other and kind of competing over who could format it the best.
Okay.
So he asked the question.
It's all good.
The fundamental question he sort of asked is how many edits are normal on an answer? And I think based on that anecdote, you might think it's a lot. And I think what it looks like is not every question has this experience. So some questions only get one answer and it's the right answer and people leave it alone. And in some cases, I think also you get a large number of answers.
Right.
And maybe the top two are getting edited, but the others kind of just go, we're three, four, whatever, and don't bother. It looks like a quick scan of the data. I took a lot of random questions from this year. The answer is essentially, on average, roughly every other answer gets edited.
So 50% of answers are edited.
Yeah, so the average number of edits is actually 0.44 edits per answer. The distribution's a little more interesting. 72% of answers don't get edited. 19% get one edit, and then 9% get two or more.
Okay.
Questions get edited more, which kind of makes...
That's a lot more than I would have thought.
I guess I would have thought higher, but I was thinking of questions, I think. So questions do get more edits than answers on average.
Yeah.
Because you get feedback. What about this? Can you clarify that?
Because I was thinking there's a lot of answers that are just sort of, you know, they sort of fall below everybody's radar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, but because answers more than questions, I think, are more likely to come from regular users.
Right.
And I think, I don't know, speaking as myself, when I type an answer, I'll put an answer in, and then I often almost immediately go in and tweak a couple things. Like, I feel like I could have written it more clearly or whatever. I don't know. But questions get more. So questions are edited roughly once. So about half of questions get no edits. 25% get one, 13% get two, and then 11% get over two.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing too startling in there, but users want to know.
There we go. Hey, if somebody wants to submit a question for the next episode of the Stack Exchange podcast, where would they go?
They can go to the URL that is about to be said by producer Al.
s.tk/podcastquestions. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, of course it is. And you can, I believe, either record it or draw a picture of your question or just type it if you're boring.
Draw a picture using...
Draw a picture of a Siberian Husky and we'll feature it on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the best picture of a Siberian Husky gets a t-shirt.
That is true. we will stand by Joel's statement.
Best Siberian Husky submitted to the podcast.
One other, I think, submission that I think we should read about. This was not exactly a question. I'm not going to say who it came from, but we got this in our support inbox. And the question is kind of a good illustrative case for us. What I'd like to know is why I am getting your silly pop-up all day on my computer.
My pop-up?
Saying Stack Overflow at line 49. This is insanity. And this is what it is doing to me every day. Yeah. Everything stops until I either exit out or click OK. Yeah.
You need a new computer.
I am an 89-year-old woman who just wants to use her computer without interference.
It's not a computer what you have there. What
Will you
have there
is a relic.
Will you
kindly get the heck off everything I'm working on my computer? I'm sick of your dumb pop-up.
This is why we named the company Stack Exchange.
Because
we didn't want to somehow be listed in the registrar of companies as the company responsible for the Stack Overflow.
We do regularly come up, I think, in people's like Facebook help search results. They find help about like Facebook programming on our site. So we get a lot of questions saying, I can't log into Facebook, please help me, or directed to us.
We do get those
but
in our email.
This was the first time, to my knowledge, we were accused of being responsible for a Stack Overflow error on someone's computer.
Happened before, but that was the first time. It might have been the first time it was by an 89-year-old woman. That's unusual.
And in her defense, she was actually very clear. She really laid out the specific error message. He actually gave us all the information
we would
need.
We needed to answer her question. If only she had posted us a question instead of a...
And so the response is, what happened? You've probably written a loop somewhere that's not terminating.
No,
so
check your
code for a while loop.
It's some sort of
loops,
it's virus or some like pop-up bar that she's gotten installed that's causing an error in the page. That's why it's happening on all websites.
We actually wrote back that it was not constructive and she should read the frigging manual, is what we told her.
Closed as not constructive.
Have you uploaded a Gravatar? Because just with all the little diamonds that you have here, hard to really know. Okay. You've been listening to Stack Exchange Podcast number 44. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Anything else I should announce? Alex,
nope.
What kind of stuff, like anything we should tell people to go to? Robert, where can people find you if they want to hear more about the Age of Context?
If you can't find me, I don't know.
Yeah,
you're trying.
Just go to Google.
Scobalizer.com.
Scobalizer. Go to Google and type
Scobalizer
anything.
On Twitter. Robert Scobal on Facebook. Scobalizer on LinkedIn, Instagram, Google Plus,
and
Tumblr.
Just don't worry. Robert Scobal will find
just
you.
Just Google me somewhere.
All Robert of MySpace is now Robert Scobal.
Yeah. How many Twitter followers do you have?
300,000, something like 3.2 million on Google Plus.
No, that's way more than
there were 3.2 million people on Google Plus.
I don't know why Google Plus is. Could you please tell them to follow me? I'm at Spolsky and I don't have any followers.
You don't want my followers. What you want are the real followers who will actually click follow instead of being gifted to you by the suggested user list.
Yeah.
Those are hard to get.
Oh, that's
really hard to get.
Anil Dash complains about that all the time. He has even more followers than you, I think, because he was kind of early. Got 448,000, and he's like, they're worthless. None of them click on anything. They're all like,
they're all just fake attractive women.
I think they're little eggs with
fake attractive
color.
Eggs.
Oh, maybe when you make a fake account that you're going to sell, it's got to follow some plausible people. And so,
yeah.
Well, it's funny. At Flipboard this morning, I was talking about this. That now content systems are becoming filtered. So it's not enough to have followers, that you actually have to get through the filter to get to somebody's page, right? Which means you have to have good content that gets people to like it, comment on it, share it, retweet it, favorite it, and read it, actually. You know, and their systems are watching all of those signals, all of those behaviors to decide what gets through to other people. And so that's even harder, because it's hard to come up with good content.
No, they just scrape it. They just scrape random crap. I was noticing for a while, like every single day when I looked at my at replies on Twitter, which is now called Connect, I would see somebody retweeting this thing that I don't even remember saying, which was something like, you know, pay attention to your customers, not your competitors. You know, startup quotes from @Spolsky. And just a different person was saying that every single day, quoting me. It was like my thing in quotes saying, you know, from Spolsky. And I don't know where they were all getting it from and what was causing this to retweet this. And suddenly I realized that somebody had gone and scraped a whole bunch of random content from the web and had a whole farm of fake Twitter accounts that were constantly retweeting all this random content that they had farmed from all over the web, try to make them look like real accounts. So those accounts, when you drill down and look at them, they're tweeting things, they're saying things, they're talking to each other, they're following each other, they're behaving very much like real people, so that there's no way to sort of detect them as being spam when they actually go and do something like, you know, that they shouldn't be. I'm not even sure what they're doing. This the whole whole thing is too complicated for it.
Joel, I think you might be encountering real people
on
Twitter for the first time.
No, they're not. They're not. I'll show you. We'll follow them. Remember that there's eHorse.
Okay,
books?
Look at the show notes. We will be posting links to several fake Twitter accounts that horse. Joel has discovered.
Do you know about horse ebooks?
No.
Just like Facebook for dogs? I would like to invest in this.
It's a check out the show notes. It's a Twitter account that posts things that are inadvertently hilarious. But they're just like little clips here. Here's one.
Why is it called eHorse Books?
It's horse_ebooks. Here's some recent tweets from Horse Ebooks. Themselves into a Saturday. We make excuses. We don't know what to do. We're greedy. Habit. How to act as an export.
Not really getting
what
this.
Is happening to us right now.
You don't have to gulp. You have.
That's been podcast number 44.
It's now got 157,000 real followers.
You started the ending and then you
because
can finish
this
it.
Algorithm that they chose for horse ebooks to just randomly grab little things from the internet to attempt to look like a real account is generating such amusing garbage that people actually follow this and laugh at it because it's almost
those
like
were
this
just
obscure
series
kind
of
poetry.
Random words.
They kind of were. What they are is they're they're 5 to 10 word phrases chosen at random from around the internet and just pasted into a Twitter account. But one thinks nobody has ever been able to figure out what the hell this is. Or where
sounds
it comes
like
from.
They've gotten you to devote quite some time to it, though.
They actually do have a website, if you click through, that sells books about horses. Anyway, this podcast has obviously gone on too long, but I already signed out. Are we still recording, Producer Alex?
Yep.
Unfortunately, we are. Thank you
very
much,
goodbye.
Robert, for being on the show, even though it degraded into uselessness towards the end. It was fascinating at the beginning to get your perspective on the future.
Thank you.
And
I got to run, so
okay.
They're kicking me out of Flipboard here.
Yeah,
I guess they're going to talk they're about
flipping,
something.
flipping you out of Flipboard. All right, and I'm going to download all those apps that you talked about, so I too will be a member of the future if I can just wait long enough to get on there on the apps.
All right, accepted. Thanks, Robert.
Great, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robert.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Wait, sorry. I thought we were going to be talking about rap today.
About what?
I thought we were talking about rap and the issues facing the rap community today.
there was a suggestion at lunch to talk about that. And then I realized that we were uniquely unqualified to talk about all the people that are unqualified to talk about rap.